Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen. And then it just does that. From New Orleans, Louisiana, as I say. Now we see that, according to latest reports, the Syrians have destroyed remember the Syrians? About 80% of their chemical weapons. Remember chemical weapons? So they're well along the way, apparently. So maybe it's time for us to mind our own chemical weapon business. How to dispose of U.S. chemical weapons emoldering in Panama is a matter Vice President Joe Biden will address when he visits Panama tomorrow, Monday. Panama has for years been trying to convince Washington to take responsibility for 8 undetonated munitions the U.S. Army abandoned on San Jose Island after ending its chemical weapons testing program there in 1947. That's all, just 1947, ladies and gentlemen. Not anything to... Panama's foreign minister recently told McClatchy newspapers a cleanup agreement has been reached with the United States. No official announcement. Biden says it will be part of the discussions. Washington has been discussing disposal of the chemical munitions with Panama since May of 2013, said the official. So these things, you know, they take their time. This is something we're reviewing right now and have committed to resolving in a timely manner, said a U.S. official. And by timely manner, he, of course, means 67 years later. Panamanian Foreign Minister Nunez Fabrega, in an interview with McClatchy newspapers last month, said, I have a firm commitment from the United States on the plans for U.S. military personnel to survey an area of privately owned San Jose Island where the chemical arms are located and to destroy the munitions in 2014. And that, sir, you can take to the bank. Unfortunately, the bank is J.P. Morgan Chase. But eventually, 8 undetonated chemical munitions that we just left there because we're a responsible big power. Now, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps not surprising. I tell friends I have a category that grows increasingly large with developments in this modern world. It's a category called amazing, but not surprising. And this fits neatly into that category. I don't believe it's been reported in American media, but this report is from the British newspaper, The Financial Times. Risky lending practices that were a hallmark of the boom years before the financial crisis are staging a comeback in the United States. This would be, I think, ultimate proof that they misnamed the species because Homo is not sapiens. Companies are taking advantage of investor hunger for higher returns in this era of zero interest rates. The issuance of payment-in-kind toggle notes, that's cute, which give a company the option to pay lenders with more debt rather than cash in times of squeezed finances, has surged in recent months. The esoteric debt structures, last time we heard that phrase, of course, was 2006, 2007, 2008, last gained prominence, says the Financial Times, during the leveraged buyout boom that defined the credit bubble of the last decade, and their return has raised concerns that markets could once again be overheating. What could possibly go wrong? Issuance of this kind of debt, payment-in-kind toggle notes, they always give them cute names, though. I give them that. The issuance of these notes has taken off in the past month with deals from Neiman Marcus, a drive-through burger joint Checkers and Rallies, and Ancestry.com, pushing the amount sold so far this year to $9 billion, according to Standard & Poor's. That's the highest volume since 2008. A wave of junk-rated borrowers has also included these exotic structures as part of new bond deals earlier this year. They were widely criticized, these things were, for fueling the bubble in cheap credit before the mid-2000s crisis. About 32% of the companies that issued such bonds during the bubble era defaulted at some point, according to Moody's, although the rating agency says the outlook for today's issuers is less bleak. Hi, I'm Les Bleak, and welcome to the show. Tonight, Emergency economic policies from the Federal Reserve have prompted the return of other risky instruments, including loans that come with fewer protections for lenders, collateralized loan obligations that slice and dice leveraged loans, and junk bonds. The worry is that the central bank's insistence on keeping interest rates low is fueling cheap and easy credit while storing up problems that may surface later on. The reemergence of these exotic instruments comes, says the FT, comes amid a wave of balance sheet refinancings that have enabled companies to loosen deal terms and pay out money to shareholders in the form of dividends. They're also gaining traction as investors continue to move into higher yielding debt and other assets as interest rates remain near record lows. So, as I say, homo, not sapiens. I'm in New Orleans, as I mentioned, and of course one knew this time would come, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and the wave of broadcasts about the subject. Just willy-nilly, I was walking down Governor Nichols Street in the French Quarter today. Before this broadcast, if I'd done it after this broadcast, of course, I wouldn't be aware of it yet, and passed by the little apartment courtyard that was the residence, I believe, of Clay Shaw, and it has a little plaque on it that cites him as the father of the restoration of the French Quarter. Of course, some people would know him for other things. Probably the darkest note of all the remembrances so far was the observation by somebody with an eye on statistics that for more than half of the American public alive right now, the most salient, the most present version of events of that day is the one in the Oliver Stone movie. Hello, welcome to the show.
Mama get up early, early in the morning. Papa's already gone. Gone out of work and for half of what he's worth now. And you know that's wrong. What happened to the Liberty Bell? I've heard so much about. Did it really ding dong?
It must have dinged wrong. It didn't ding long. Pray tell what's gonna happen to brother. Who's gonna help him get further? One another. Is that the truth? One another. Yeah, you're right. Pray tell what's gonna happen to brother. Who's gonna help him get further? One another. Is that the truth? One another. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Did it really ding dong?
Ding dong.
Hey, it must have dinged wrong. It didn't ding long. Did it really ding dong? It must have dinged wrong. It didn't ding long. Did it really ding dong?
Ding dong.
Hey, it must have dinged wrong. It didn't ding long. Did it really ding dong?
Ding dong.
It must have dinged wrong. It didn't ding long.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Any journalist who uses a phone, tablet, or pocket camera to take photos and shoot videos at the Sochi Winter Olympics will be stripped of accreditation on the spot. Yes, journalists who use amateur standard technology to take pictures or videos of next February's Winter Olympics in Russia will be kicked out immediately, according to the head of the Olympic Accreditation Committee, Vasily Konov. He told a seminar for sports journalists that print reporters using any sort of multimedia would be, quote, considered a serious violation and lead to their accreditation being canceled. Only journalists with professional equipment and special badges will be allowed to do so. Of course, if you've been following trends in print media, I was with somebody last night who was in Chicago when Chicago Sun-Times fired all their photographers because you don't need photographers to take photographs anymore, just a reporter with a phone. So, running smack dab into this. Organizers won't be able to have any effect on normal spectators, but reporters will be banned from bringing non-professional equipment to the competitions, said Konov. Several journalists have already fallen foul of the strict accreditation regulations surrounding the Olympics. Dmitry Navosha, director of the popular sports site accused the state-run news agency of denying his correspondents accreditation because they were a vastly more popular competitor. Independent Dutch journalists working on a long-term multimedia project about Sochi were denied renewed press credentials in September. Don't be bringing those don't be bringing your phone in. Get an expensive. And the people of Bavaria were asked last week to cast their votes on whether the region should apply to host the 2022 Winter Olympics. And their answer, according to Der Spiegel, a resounding nine. A stinging blow to the country's reputation as a sporting nation, said the dejected backers of the bid. A total of 1.3 million eligible voters rejected the bid by clear majorities of between 52 and 59%. There was no immediate comment from Thomas Bach, the German president of the International Olympics Committee. It was the first time an Olympic bid in Germany had been put to a public vote, and maybe the last. The opponents had argued the event would damage the environment, cost too much, and lock local authorities and businesses into gagging contracts meant to protect Olympic sponsors. The vote, said commentators, reflected growing public mistrust of major sports federations in the wake of doping and corruption scandals. following a series of public protests against major sports events around the world this year. German soccer legend Franz Beckenbauer, who led the successful bid to host the 2006 World Cup in Germany, said, "They'll regret that someday." But he was kidding, wasn't he? Germans kid, don't they? The Olympics. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. That's what happens when you let people vote, ladies and gentlemen. This democracy thing is so overrated. As evidenced by some secret stuff I get to tell you this week. U.S. agencies collected and shared the personal information of thousands of Americans in an attempt to root out untrustworthy federal workers. But this ended up scrutinizing people who had no direct ties to the U.S. government and who had simply purchased certain books. This is from McClatchy newspapers. Federal officials gathered the information from the customer records of two men who were under criminal investigation for purportedly teaching people how to pass lie detector tests, which, as you know, don't really detect lies. The officials then distributed a list of 4,900 people with many of their social security numbers, addresses, and professions to nearly 30 federal agencies, including the IRS, the CIA, the NSA, and the Food and Drug Administration. Although the polygraph beating techniques are unproven, authorities hope to find government employees or applicants who might have tried to use them to lie during the tests required for security clearances. That's right, they use them for security clearances, even though they're not scientifically, Officials with multiple agencies confirmed they'd checked the names in their databases and plan to retain the list, just in case any of those named take polygraphs for federal jobs or criminal investigations. Gets better, doesn't it? It turned out, however, many people on the list worked outside the federal government and lived across the country. Nurses, firefighters, police officers, and private attorneys. A psychologist, a cancer researcher, employees of Rite Aid, the Red Cross, and Paramount Pictures. It's about time. Moreover, many of them had only bought books or DVDs from one of the men being investigated and didn't receive the one-on-one training in beating the polygraph that investigators had suspected. A Washington lawyer was listed even though he'd never contacted the instructors. Dozens of others had wanted to pass a polygraph not for a job, but for a personal reason. Spouses who suspected infidelity. The unprecedented creation of such a list and decision to disseminate it widely demonstrate the ease with which the federal government can collect and share Americans' personal information even when there's no clear reason for doing so. And from the MIT Technology Review, also on the subject of secret stuff, reports of the NSA's surveillance programs based on the leaks of Edward Snowden have been embarrassing or enraging, but to governments and security services in developing economies, they will prove inspirational. This according to a report from the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab, which studies online security and privacy, because the rest of us are studying Rob Ford, mayor of Toronto. He's good for the brand. You no longer think of Canada as boring. Back to the story. The report warns that governments that already impose authoritarian controls on the Internet, such as China, India, and Saudi Arabia, may now seek to boost those efforts with NSA-style bulk collection programs that trample on civil liberties. Ron Diebert, director of Citizens Lab, says no doubt one implication of Snowden's revelations will be the spurring on of numerous national efforts to regain control of information infrastructures through setting up national competitors to Google, Verizon, and other companies implicated, not to mention the development of national signals intelligence programs that attempt to duplicate the U.S. model, unquote. Many countries of the global south, he adds, lack even basic safeguards and accountability mechanisms around the operation of security services, and their demands on the private sector could contribute to serious human rights violations and other forms of repression. India, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia already demand that BlackBerry add interception technology to its services. Diebert says insisting that companies add such backdoors to their services introduces serious security risks because they could be discovered and abused by criminals. Citizens Lab has evidence to back up that argument. In 2008, researchers in the group discovered that the Chinese version of Skype had been modified to help the Chinese government's surveillance efforts. The program sent chat logs to a government server if certain keywords were typed, but that server was not password protected. Anyone could download millions of personal conversations collected by the authorities, including credit card numbers and other sensitive information. Well done, NSA. Leading the way. Of course it rhymes. It's so you can remember it. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
Eddie?
I didn't go by Clay Shaw's house. I didn't think it was proper.
Well, I don't think that's really the issue here. I didn't do it deliberately. I don't like being rebuked by an atom, by the way.
Yeah. Take your chances, you know? I'm a free atom.
Really? Not a free radical, I hope.
No. Free moderate.
Trucks hauling dangerous uranium waste from Tennessee for burial in a landfill at the Nevada National Security Site will start rolling early next year despite objections from the Nevada governor, who is powerless to stop them, according to federal officials. DOE officials insist that strategy will be safe, despite lingering questions about the suitability of disposing potent, highly radioactive nuclear material in trenches deeper than 40 feet in the southeast part of the former Nevada bomb test site.
40 feet is plenty deep.
40 feet, you think?
Sure.
Kevin Knobloch, chief of staff to the energy secretary, says Nevada cannot veto the disposal plan at the government's self-regulated site. Self-regulation always works, doesn't it?
Sure.
That leaves the state with the possible threat of legal action or intervention by Nevada's congressional delegation. This is according to the Las Vegas Review-Journal. What's going to be shipped are canisters containing a ceramic mixture of three uranium isotopes, 233, 235, and 232.
My favorites.
Between 50 and 100 shipments will be made over a period of 18 months to 3 years. The majority of the waste material is uranium-235. That's used in some nuclear bombs that were tested at the Nevada test site. 10% of the waste consists of another isotope, 233. It's also a nuclear bomb material and will be around at least 159,200 years before half of its radioactivity decays to a safer level. That's its half-life.
It's less than 200,000 years?
It is. Look on the bright side, as you'd always do. Despite the atomic bomb materials that the DOE officials say are benign, because neutron-absorbing ingredients have been mixed in to avoid the risk, or to reduce the risk, not avoid it, sorry, of an accidental nuclear reaction, Nevada officials are concerned that an impurity in the hands of terrorists could be turned into a dirty bomb. The impurity is the other isotope, uranium-232. It has a much shorter half-life, just 70 years. Waste containing it requires heavy shielding and must be handled using remote-controlled cranes.
They're better than remote-controlled Starks.
Cute. As it decays, U-232 creates a new menace, thallium-208. That offspring emits short-lived but intense deadly gamma rays that are radiotoxic or biologically harmful to the human environment. Anyone tampering with the uranium-tainted waste in the canisters to extract material for a dirty bomb would risk death by gamma ray exposure.
That's a negative incentive.
It is. Because of the high percentage of atom-splitting bomb ingredients, the material should not be permanently buried as low-level waste in a landfill because it doesn't meet NRC low-level radioactive waste guidelines. That's according to a former Yucca Mountain chief scientist who works as a consultant now to one of the counties in Nevada. Some critics have noted the DOE quietly changed its waste acceptance criteria last May so that these canisters from Oak Ridge could be disposed of as low-level waste, although it's five times more radioactive than previously allowed.
That's called progress.
The DOE's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Environmental Management says the agency's climate analysis shows there will be no appreciable release from the landfill before 10,000 years.
Stick around.
Yeah, keep watching. Watch this space. A federal judge has awarded three New England nuclear power companies $235 million in damages in the second of three cases against the U.S. government because the U.S. government failed to take care of disposing of the plant's nuclear waste. Oh, here's that nuclear waste thing again. The federal government has 60 days to appeal. The companies operated, so you can sue the federal government if they don't truck away your nuclear waste. The companies operated the Connecticut Yankee nuclear plant and two plants in Maine and Massachusetts, which have been deactivated for decades. If the judgment stands, millions of dollars in damages will go to the ratepayers of the utilities that run those plants. Ratepayers for years paid fees to the federal government to have the spent fuel removed from the sites, but the government never picked up the waste as plans for a national disposal site fell apart. And still sitting there, apparently.
I don't know what the fuss is.
It's now some real fuss. If you don't know that fuss, you'll know this fuss. Sir Adam. Three of the spent fuel assemblies due to be carefully plucked from the crippled Japanese nuclear plant at Fuke in a hazardous year-long operation were damaged even before the 2011. The plant's operator, TEPCO, said the damaged assembly, racks that contain 50 to 70 thin rods of highly irradiated used fuel, they can't be removed using the large cask assigned to taking out more than 1,500 of the assemblies. One of the assemblies was damaged as far back as 1982 when it was mishandled during a transfer, and it is bent out of shape.
Didn't stop Bill Clinton.
I thought you'd say that. TEPCO said in a brief note in an information sheet that it put out in August. That's how we know this. In a statement from April 2010, TEPCO said it found two other spent fuel racks in the reactor's cooling pool had what appeared to be wire trapped in them. Rods in those assemblies have pinhole cracks and are leaking low-level radioactive gases.
Low-level gas can't hurt you.
The existence of the damaged racks, reported in a Fuke regional newspaper on Wednesday, came to light as TEPCO was preparing to begin decommissioning the plant by removing all the spent fuel assemblies. We are currently reviewing how to transport these damaged fuel assemblies, said the TEPCO spokesperson. The process, of course, risky enough on its own, but now the operation has been postponed because new video footage from a robot has revealed new leaks within the damaged reactors, meaning the rods now can't be taken out as planned.
The rods must be disappointed.
If they have feelings, I think they would be. The mayor of Hollywood, Alabama, they got a Hollywood in Alabama, calls the unfinished Bellefont nuclear plant where he once worked the eighth wonder of the world. Bellefont is as fine of a built facility as there is, but DVA keeps changing its mind about what it will do with it, says Buster Duke, a retired DVA employee who was elected mayor of the plant's hometown last year. We would love to see it finished and operating someday, but once again, we seem to be getting a different message from TVA. The TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, resurrected engineering work on the stalled twin reactor project in 2011, but it halted work again this summer as it released new cost estimates suggesting completion of the plant will cost from 50 to 78% more than what was projected just 2 years ago.
Have to fix those projectors.
Yes, they do. The estimated price of just one of the units raised to between $7.4 billion and $8.7 billion. In 2011, TVA's estimate was $4.9 billion. The physical plant was built with quality and is a tremendous asset, said former TVA Chief Operating Officer Bill McCollum, who questioned the new higher estimates. He now works as a consultant for a private investment group headed by a financier who proposed a $10 billion deal to privately finance the completion of both reactors. But the plan doesn't make economic sense for the TVA. The TVA says an initial $3.5 billion price tag to finish a plant 5 years ago has since jumped to more than $4 billion, and there are cost overruns at other new plants under construction in Georgia and South Carolina, which convinced TVA to raise its estimate. "We've learned from those experiences," said the TVA official.
See? Homo sapiens, after all.
You listened to the show. Good. Two U.S. senators have accused the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of backing away from a probe of the worsening finances of Entergy's nuclear plants. And back to Fuchs one more time. One day last year, nuclear cleanup worker Toyotatsu Uechi was asked to put a lid on one of the tanks at Fuchs. He pulled on the yellow bodysuit, which is required for areas of the plant with high radiation. When he reached the opening, he couldn't believe what he saw. The opening did not have a proper lid, but was instead covered with duct tape. He remembers another incident when working on patching up the floor of a reactor building where a boss at the plant told him to focus on getting the job done in time rather than on quality. Channel 4 News in England contacted TEPCO about these incidents. TEPCO said many of the workers at Fuchs are employed by subsidiary companies rather than TEPCO, meaning the company may not know about the incidents. But she said she'd passed on the reports to people in charge at the plant and would continue to investigate. Channel 4 News is awaiting comment from the subsidiary company Uechi was employed by.
Duct tape can't kill you.
Duct tape can't kill you is correct. Clean, cheap, safe. Too full of duct tape to meter, our friend the atom. This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, you are probably aware, you'd have to be as out of touch as I was a couple of weeks ago to not be aware that this week the talk in Washington is of the, not the botched website anymore, but the deeper problems, apparently, with the Affordable Care Act, namely, as was discussed on this program last week, the increasing numbers of people who are coming forward and saying, despite the president's pledge that if you like your existing health plan, you can keep it, they are having their health plans canceled. The pressure was ratcheted up this week when former President Bill Clinton, in an interview, said this.
I personally believe, even if it takes a change in the law, the president should honor the commitment the federal government made to those people and let them keep what they got.
That was Bill Clinton, who, you know, was just sitting around watching things happen. The president finally, as the pressure mounted this week, held a news conference on Thursday and inauspiciously began it with these words. This, no editing, ladies and gentlemen, no tricks. These are the words with which he began his Thursday press conference.
Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon.
That doesn't inspire the greatest amount of confidence in the world when he can't even figure out what time of day it is. And then, in the course of explaining why he had made the pledge and the pledge didn't turn out to be correct, that you could keep your plan, and what they're doing to solve it now, the president said this.
What we're also discovering is that insurance is complicated to buy. And another mistake that we made, I think, was underestimating the difficulties of people purchasing insurance online and shopping for a lot of options with a lot of costs and a lot of different benefits and plans, and somehow expecting that that would be very smooth. And then they've also got to try to apply for tax credits on the website. So,
yeah, right. It's insurance is complicated to buy. Who knew? So, just imagining, ladies and gentlemen, what may have triggered the president's statement on Thursday at that press conference, that he had a fix. He was proposing a fix that would allow people, in fact, to keep their plans for a year. What might have motivated that? We'll try to figure it out next here on the show.
Clinton something. The Wilderness Years.
Thanks for coming up to Harlem. I figured this would be less hassle than meeting at the Global Initiative office.
And cost me less money to get in, too. Actually, I was doing a couple of fundraisers in the city, so I only had to screw up traffic for a few dozen more blocks.
Yeah, I would have been at one of those fundraisers, but it cost me less money to see you here.
So, look, Mr. President.
Oh, come on, man. Call me Bill. We're in Harlem. Who's going to hear us? Al Sharpton?
Okay, Bill. And you can call me Mr. President.
Got it.
So, look. You know, mm-hmm. I'm eternally grateful for the help you gave us in 2012. I mean, aside from the technology kids, I think you were the reason we won.
You know, I kind of think, regardless of the technology kids, I was the reason you won. But, hey, I've always been a big-headed son of a gun. I guess that's kind of why I presumed to speak out on this whole health care, what's the official word for it, mess, screw-up, debacle, disaster, fuster-cluck?
Well, whatever you call it. I own it.
You and about 250 congressional and Senate Democrats who are about this close to hiring an investigator to see if you put any money into Whitewater. I mean, man, have you been talking to your people on the Hill?
No, I leave that to the folks who are paid to do that. I mean, as you know better than anyone, about this time in your second term, your plate gets so full.
You need another couple of plates.
But I know our folks in the Congress have taken some heat on this. Mm-hmm. I know they got 2014 on their minds, and which is why I've been doing these fundraisers. If we can just keep the Democratic Senate and flip the House, then my last 2 years I could...
get decent funding for your presidential library. And that's about it for the best case scenario. Look, man, I'm suggesting you do something I myself couldn't do until I changed my way of eating. And that's think long term. You want some nachos?
No, thanks.
So forget 2014. Let's think 2016 for a minute.
Or if I'm you, steadily for the next 3 years.
Hey, somebody's got to.
Oh.
You got 4, maybe 5 million people walking around right now saying the president told me I could keep my health care plan, and I can't.
Mm-hmm.
These people have Twitter and Facebook accounts. They know how to reach the bookers at CNN and Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the power to turn the Democratic brand into the government is incompetent and you can't trust it. Now, how's that going to benefit our candidate in 2016?
You mean your wife?
I mean whoever. You know, Joe Biden's got a shot.
I'm betting that's something you don't say to Hillary.
There's about 2 million things I don't say to Hillary. But now let's shug right down to the cob here. Are you really ready to turn your whole legacy over to Ted Cruz, Paul Ryan, or Rick Perry just because you repeated a stupid promise more often than the men's warehouse guy? And by the way, he's gone too.
Hey, sue me. I actually believed it. I believed what my folks were telling me. Now it turns out the whole insurance thing is way more complicated than buying a book on Amazon. And you know, unless you have one click, that's not the easiest thing in the world for a lot of people either.
Well, it's your business who you put in the offices near yours, but if my folks steered me that wrong, I'd have had them taking out Steny Hoyer's trash by noon the next day. Look, there's got to be some way you can say, okay, I screwed up, but we got a fix here, and now you really can keep your plan. And kind of mean it.
I'm told we can say that, but only for a year, or else it screws up the whole actuarial model with the ACA, and only if the state insurance commissioners agree and...
Look, man, I'm not policy, you're not policy. We're politics.
Mm-hmm.
I got people, you got people.
Mm-hmm.
My people got you up here, good for them. Your people made nice with the insurance companies. So have them make it happen. Make believe you're president or something.
I'm going to assume... that's something you do tell Hillary.
Every damn day.
Well, thanks, Bill. Thanks for the advice, which, unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to try to follow. And, hey, you know, it's always nice to visit Harlem.
Youthful angst and middle-aged powerlessness. Together, they add up to Clinton something, the wilderness years.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, there's no reason to start anywhere else than with, I think, 2013's Apology King, Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, who started the barrage with the following statement at a press conference.
Oh, and the last thing was Olivia Gondak. It says that I wanted to eat her. I've never said that in my life to her. I would never do that. I'm happily married. I've got more than enough to eat at home. Thank you very much.
What about drinking and driving, Mayor? What about drinking and driving?
Oh my God.
And then...
I want to apologize for my graphic remarks this morning. For the past 6 months, I have been under tremendous, tremendous stress. The stress is largely of my own making. Today, I acted on complete impulse in my remarks. I fully realize in the past, I have drank alcohol in excess. I wish you to know I'm receiving support from a team of healthcare professionals. I am taking accountability and receiving advice from people with expertise. I do not wish to comment on the particulars of this support.
Okay, then. Kids, don't try this at home. Don't say I have drank. Former Orlando Magic forward Matt Barnes apologized for a Twitter rant laced with the N-word following his ejection from a game with the Oklahoma City Thunder. Barnes intervened during a heated exchange between Blake Griffin, oh, the Kia guy, and Serge Ibaka. He pushed Ibaka and later tweeted, "Love my teammates like family, but I'm done standing up for these N-word. All this expletive does is cost me money." Barnes later deleted the tweet but followed up with a lengthy apology. "I'd like to take a second to apologize to the Clipper organization and the Clip fans for my actions not only on the court but off. I was completely wrong for pushing Ibaka and then for what I tweeted following the altercation. My poor choice of words and timing do not reflect who or what I am about. Now I could have took the easy way out and said my Twitter was hacked, but that's not what I'm about. I accept full responsibility." Exceptt. College-educated young man, ladies and gentlemen. New England Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski apologized this week after a videotape of him mocking a man of Asian heritage at a Foxborough bar last week was posted online. "I feel bad, personally. I feel bad," Gronkowski said during his first media availability. "I talked to the fan and he assured me that he took no offense in any way. I know others did, and I apologize to those who took offense." That's it. To those apology. Scholastic Incorporated has apologized for publishing a map of the Middle East that omits Israel in a popular series of children's books. On Wednesday, hours after the Times of Israel reported about the mission in Thea Stilton and the Blue Scarab Hunt, the book publisher in a statement on its website said it was stopping shipment immediately of the title, revising the map, and reprinting the book. The book, part of Scholastic's Geronimo Stilton series, was published June of last year. It tells of a journalist mouse who travels to Egypt. "We regret the omission, which was in the original version of the book published in Italy and was translated by our company for English language distribution," the statement said. Blame the Italians. They don't know how to make maps. That's why they had so few colonies. Would that be correct history? Let's check on that. I think I'll stand by that. Annandale High School principal Vincent Randazzo apologized to the Annandale community this week following reports that the varsity football coach interrupted the Adams Mar- That's a little too local. Deadline Sydney, Australia, an Australian brewery has apologized for using images of Hindu deities on its alcoholic ginger beer bottles after the labels provoked outrage from Hindu devotees. Brookvale Union Brewery's line of ginger beer carried a composite picture of the face of the Hindu god Ganesh, juxtaposed with the body of the goddess Lakshmi, while other religious motifs appear in the background. Rajan Zed, president of the Universal Society of Hinduism, said the labels were highly inappropriate and called for their immediate removal. "We're lovers, not fighters. We want to make it right," the brewery said in an apology. "With recent feedback brought into our attention, we'll be looking at design options for our bottles," in an accent of no discernible provenance. The company said it had used the images to complement the drink's flair, feel, and colors of the Asian continent. Hinduism is the third largest religion in the world, with about 1 billion followers. Lord Ganesh and Goddess Lakshmi were highly revered in Hinduism, and they were meant to be worshipped in temples or home shrines and not to be used in selling beer, said Zod. Yeah, but that was then. San Jose's chief of police said, "I apologize," this week after an investigative unit for the local NBC TV affiliate exposed the department playing a numbers game with crime statistics, misleading the public about a decline in gang-related homicides. That doesn't happen anywhere else. New Orleans! Sarah Palin attempted to clarify comments she made about the Pope in an interview, the head of the Catholic Church, that Pope, in an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper, saying on Facebook that she was not trying to be critical of Pope Francis when she said some of his statements sound kind of liberal. Quote, "I was reminding viewers that we need to do our own homework on news subjects, and I hadn't done mine yet on the Pope's recent comments as reported by the media. She doesn't trust the media to get it right. I do, however, trust my many Catholic friends and family, including some excellent Catholic writers. I apologize for not being clearer in my response, thus opening the door to critical media that does what it does best in ginning up controversy, as opposed to Sarah Palin, who does what she does best by appearing in the media. Oh, and then there's Alec Baldwin. In a video posted on TMZ this week, Alec Baldwin insulted, stomped after, and generally tried to intimidate a paparazzo who attempted to photograph the actor, his wife, and their newborn in New York City. Before driving off, Baldwin called the photographer a C-sucking F, according to TMZ, which also published audio of the incident. Baldwin insisted that C-sucker was not intended as an anti-gay comment. If C-sucker offends, then I apologize. Anti-gay never, he tweeted. He then tweeted that he learned from the vice president of communication of GLAAD that C-sucker has homophobic implications, and he apologized for using it. MSNBC, which had just given Alec Baldwin a new talk show, announced it had been pulled from the network schedule for 2 weeks, half of Sweeps Month. He posted a message of apology on MSNBC.com. I would like to address the comments I made this past week. I did not intend to hurt or offend anyone with my choice of words, but clearly I have, and for that I am deeply sorry. Words are important, I understand that, and I will choose mine with great care going forward. What I said this and did this week as I was trying to protect my family was offensive and unacceptable. Again, please accept my apology. Goldman Sachs Group Chief Executive Lloyd Blankfein said this week he regrets collateralized debt obligation trades that his outfit made in the run-up to the financial crisis. Those are pools of bonds that are bundled, sliced up according to credit risk, and sold to investors. Investment banks began selling more exotic varieties linked to mortgages as 2007 reared its ugly head. Wrong-way bets on CDOs led to billions of dollars in losses for many investors. But unlike its Wall Street peers, Goldman Sachs profited by using CDOs to bet that the mortgage market would collapse even while it sold mortgage securities. The trades were profitable at the time to the tune of some $13 billion. Goldman suffered tremendous reputational fallout, in the years after the crisis. I wish the organization hadn't done complex CDOs, he said at an industry conference. And post-crisis, I wish I'd gotten off a little quicker off the mark in describing who we were and what we did as a firm and how we looked to the world before everybody defined us for us, he said. We were competing against an existing narrative. It's very hard to get out of that. And he said, Goldman's work in repairing its reputational damage is not yet done, I'll say. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, briefly, news from outside the bubble. Fairly important story. Drug-resistant superbugs represent one of the gravest threats in the history of medicine, leading experts have warned. This from The Independent on Sunday. Routine operations could become deadly in the very near future as bacteria evolve to resist the drugs we use to combat them. This process could erase a century of medical advances, say British government doctors in a special editorial in the health journal The Lancet. The looming threat of antibiotic resistance has been known for years. The new warning reflects growing concern that health systems will struggle to cope with the rising cost of caring for people in the post-antibiotic era. England's deputy chief medical officer said, I'm concerned that in 20 years, if I go into a hospital for a hip replacement, I could get an infection leading to major complications and possible death simply because antibiotics no longer work as they do now. Writing in The Lancet, experts warn that death rates from bacterial infections might return to those of the early 20th century. They write, quote, rarely has modern medicine faced such a grave threat, unquote. A leading GP told The Independent on Sunday the time had come for the general public to take responsibility. The change needs to come in patient expectation, he said. We need public education that not every ill needs a pill. That was Dr. Peter Swinyard of the Family Doctor Association, flying in the face of zillions of dollars in pharmaceutical advertising on American television. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thank you. And a final apology. Andrew Huszar was a former Federal Reserve official responsible for executing the centerpiece program of quantitative easing. He now says in the Wall Street Journal, "I've come to recognize the program for what it really is, the greatest backdoor Wall Street bailout of all time. I'm sorry." Well, that takes care of that.
Here it is!
And there it goes.
We do not have time for this kind of silliness.
All right, sir. Thank you very much for that. That means that's the end of this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast at WWNO.org, Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, and maybe TuneIn Radio. But if you've had trouble with the podcast in the last couple of weeks, that means you have to leave the old feed and resubscribe at WWNO's Le Show. And then everything will be fine again. And it'd be just like everything being fine again if you'd agree to join with me then. Well, you already thank you very much, uh-huh. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO. For her help with today's broadcast. The email address for this broadcast, playlist of the music heard here on, and what a spectacular store. All available for you at harryshearer.com. And me, I'll be tweeting you at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO, New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from New Orleans.